pleasant afternoon. It's good to be back with you. This morning we talked about the claims of Jesus and talked about several of the things that he said that are shocking, to say the least. The fact that he claimed to be able to forgive sins, that he was actually from heaven sent down to this earth, that he was the one and only Savior of the whole world, that he was the Son of God, and meaning that in the highest possible sense, and that he was the absolute Lord of heaven and earth. As we talked about this morning, these claims of Jesus are absolutely bold and outlandish, unless they're true. And yet, really, you only have a few options. Either Jesus was telling the truth, or he was maybe delusional, or he was an absolute despicable liar. And there really is no other way to look at it. As we said this morning, you can't view Jesus as a good man. No, his claims won't allow that. And so tonight, I'd like us to think for a little bit about the evidence for the claims of Jesus. It's one thing to talk about these claims. It's one thing to talk about what the options are, but still, is there no reason for us, no real evidence for us to accept Jesus' claim? Or are we somehow called upon in the Bible to just accept the claims of Jesus just because this man 2,000 years ago came on the scene and said these things about himself? Is that the reason why we're supposed to accept it? Is there nothing else that really provides evidence for us? Really, when you look at what the Gospels are talking about, you read statements from Jesus such as this in John chapter 5 and verse 31. Jesus is reported to have said, "If I alone bear witness of myself, my testimony is not true. The works which the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I do, bear witness of me, that the Father has sent me." I find that a very intriguing admission from the lips of Jesus. He acknowledges that the mere fact that he or anyone else coming on the scene and just saying these affirmations about themselves, that doesn't make it true. That doesn't make it worthy of being accepted as true. Jesus says, no, there really has to be something else that would confirm my own personal affirmation about who and what I am. Jesus said, the works which the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I do, bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. It's clear in the context of John's gospel, he's talking about those miracles. He's talking about those miraculous signs. In fact, in John chapter 10 and verse 37, again, Jesus, in a very candid admission, says, if I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me. But if I do them, though you do not believe me, believe the works, that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father. Jesus absolutely was willing to rest everything about his claim upon the veracity of his miracles, those miraculous works. And he acknowledged that if I really am not doing these works, if these are not real miracles, then do not believe me. You have no real grounds, no real reason for believing me. But indeed, if I am doing these works, then believe me, not because I merely say these things about myself, but because I have proven it by means of these miraculous works. And indeed, in John chapter 20, this is the very point that the author of the gospel makes as an eyewitness who's recording these miraculous signs of Jesus. He says in verse 30, many other signs therefore Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. So what you see in this gospel record is an accounting of these miraculous signs that Jesus has done. And really, John in his gospel focuses in upon 8 miracles, 7 signs that Jesus performs, and the 8th, his own resurrection from the dead. And that constitutes then that evidence, that miraculous evidence for Jesus' bold claims. And so when you think about the evidence for these claims of Jesus, what we need to understand is that Jesus was affirming that these claims were based upon and in fact proven by means of his own miracles. And this is what you see when you look at these gospel records. It's always the idea that the miracles of Jesus are what confirm these claims. And if he did not do those miracles, if the evidence for those miracles was not available, or if somehow the evidence for those miracles was not credible enough to sustain and establish that he really did do these miraculous works, then by Jesus' own admission, don't believe me. You have no reason for believing me. So I say all this because I want us to really appreciate the nature of the kind of evidence that we're talking about. And I also want to say this, when you look at the kind of miracles that are being talked about, these alleged miracles, they're not the kind of things that you can just sort of dismiss and give some kind of naturalistic explanation to. It was either a miracle or it wasn't. You know, there are some things that people can claim, maybe have a supernatural origin or an explanation that is miraculous, and yet the very nature of what they're talking about, it isn't just clear and obvious that it really would be some kind of miracle, because there's a naturalistic explanation that you could give. Yeah, that point has come home to me just in my own life. Along this very line, if I wanted to, folks, I could absolutely affirm to be a miracle worker. Really could. 7 years ago when I was preaching a meeting in Fort Scott, Kansas, and I may have told you this story, I was in a church building there. There were no outside windows, and the power goes out. And it was pitch black dark. In fact, it was so dark you couldn't even see your hand in front of your face. I'm right in the middle of the sermon. Power goes out. You know, well, I obviously stopped preaching. You know, usually public speakers say, oh, just kind of go on with it if something happens. But sometimes you have to just kind of stop and acknowledge that something strange has happened. So we're just all sitting there in the dark. And a minute goes by and 2 minutes goes by. And I'm still up there, and I decided to say something smart. And I said, well, brethren, I guess if I really were intelligent here, I'd just stop and say, let there be light. And boom, the light's coming. I mean, it was like somebody was back there flipping a switch, but that wasn't the case. It just, the lights came on. Well, I mean, my goodness, that was more of a distraction to the audience than the lights going out in the first place. That's not the end of the story, though. Several years later, I was going to hold a meeting in Kansas City, Missouri. And somebody from Fort Scott, Kansas, who had happened to be at that meeting, just happened to be coming to Kansas City and was in the airport same time as I was. And so we're talking as we're going through the line there. And do you remember? Yeah, I remember that. What happened? You let there be all that stuff, you know. That very night, I'm in a meeting then at the Hickman Mills congregation. I'm up there preaching, and the power goes out. And it's just pitch black dark, you know. And, you know, and a minute goes by, and I said, this is such a coincidence, brethren, because it just so happened that several years ago I had this incident happen at Fort Scott, Kansas. Just happened today to see someone from Fort Scott. He was in the airport. We're talking about this. And lo and behold, tonight I'm up here preaching and the power goes out. I said, well, brethren, you know what? Let me try it again. Let there be light. And boom, the lights come back on. I mean, I started to get a little bit nervous. And then just a couple of, I'm not done yet. Then just a couple of years ago, I'm holding a gospel meeting in Annandale, Virginia. Liz was here this morning. She could testify. And I'm up there preaching and the lights go out. What is it with me that the lights always go out when I'm preaching? And so, you know, several minutes go by, you know, and the thought's going through my mind. Okay, Marty, now don't risk it. You know, don't, you know.
Don't have delusions of grandeur here, you know. Just don't try it again and risk it, you know, and blow your story, you know. But finally, you know, we're in the dark there, and it was just, you know, things are just... And so I just finally said, well, brethren, really just to take up time while they're trying to get the power buck on or hoping the power would come back on, I tell this story about the two occasions in the past separated by years where the same incident happened. And so I said, well, you know what? Okay, what do we have to lose? Let's go ahead and just try it. Let there be light. And boom, the lights come on again. I promise you. I thought, okay, it was so perfect that... Somebody listening to tell this story in the back, you know, and knew the power, and he flipped the switch or something. But no, it, yeah. And so I just want to say that you're looking at a miracle worker right now. Follow me, all of you believers. Well, as interesting as that story is to me, maybe it isn't to you, but to me it is, and I'll say this, as amazing. As that's because I'll have to admit to you, that is a little bit eerie, you know. In the background, whenever I think of that story, you know, I kind of hear, you know, kind of, you know. That was really an amazing incident that happened, and it was just weird. But I don't really believe that that was a miracle. And even though that is interesting and maybe just remarkable in some ways, I don't think any of you would be deceived by that and think that that was some kind of a miracle. The fact of the matter is that there's a lot of ways you could kind of explain that. Yes, it's coincidental, but you know, those kind of things can happen, and it certainly is true that when power goes off, you know, that after a few minutes it comes back on, and so, you know, I mean, those things happen. Maybe the timing was good. I'll say this. I really, if it happens again, even tonight, I'm not going to risk it. I'm not going to go for four times in a row. Because the fact of the matter is, even though that's an interesting and maybe kind of remarkable sequence of events, the kind of things we're reading about with Jesus, they're not at that level. They're far greater than that. Oh, sometimes you have people who claim to be miracle workers, and maybe somebody to whom that incident might have happened, maybe if they had a mind to, they could kind of take that and run with it and try to convince people that God was working with them and they had some power, you know, the electricity God or something, you know. But the fact of the matter is, Jesus' miracles were of such a grander scale that you couldn't just kind of dismiss them along that line. Oh, yeah, there are a lot of people that came to him maybe for healings. And I don't know the nature of all the kind of healings that Jesus was engaging in. And maybe some of those healings, the illnesses weren't that severe. But I'll tell you what, when you look at the testimony, there's a lot of illnesses there that were just absolutely so severe. People who were born blind. People who were born lame, people who were known by everybody in a village or in a city to have been this lame person from birth. So there's no way that they can somehow be deceived that, oh, well, this person has been miraculously healed when really it was not that at all. No, the miracles of Jesus are so much on a grander scale, and in fact, even culminating where in all of the Gospels, the ultimate miracle that Jesus performs is his own resurrection from the dead by the power of the Holy Spirit. And the evidence for that is so overwhelming. And so when you're looking at the evidence for the claims of Jesus, as bold and as outlandish as the claims of Jesus are, the miraculous evidence is equally bold and equally capable of establishing these bold claims of Jesus. And I'll tell you something else. The ultimate evidence for those miracles, it comes from the testimony of witnesses. And again, we all have to acknowledge that we weren't there and we didn't actually witness with our own eyes Jesus do these alleged miracles, but we are relying upon the testimony of witnesses, just like we do every day in our court system, just like we do every day in our lives when
Someone tells us about something that we haven't seen, or a reporter, he gives the news about some event that we did not personally bear witness to. We're having to rely upon the testimony of witnesses in virtually every aspect of our lives. And certainly when you look at the Gospels, what you see is this emphasis upon the testimony of witnesses. In fact, Luke, I think, illustrates what is there inherently and at least implicitly in all the other Gospels. In his prologue, he explains where he's getting his information. He says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word have handed them down to us, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you might know the exact truth about the things you have been taught." So what you see here with the Gospel of Luke is the author, the evangelist, was not himself an eyewitness of the things that Jesus did, but he is indicating here, I have spoken with the eyewitnesses. I have recorded their accounts of what they saw Jesus do, what they say that they saw him do with their own eyes, what they heard him say, what they heard him teach. And I've written this down very carefully, he says, so that you may know the exact truth. What you see when you look at the Gospels, it's always evidence for the claims of Jesus based on his miracles. And how do we know those miracles really took place? It's always an appeal to eyewitness testimony. People who were there. We may not have been there, but people who were there who are giving their testimony, and the gospel writers are recording that. Again, this is the emphasis you see in Acts chapter 10 and the account of Peter's speech to the household of Cornelius. Look at his emphasis here. He says, "We are witnesses of all the things Jesus did both in the land of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They also put him to death by hanging him on a cross. God raised him up on the third day and granted that he become visible, not to all the people, but to witnesses who were chosen beforehand by God. That is, to us who ate and drank with him after he arose from the dead. And he ordered us to preach to the people and solemnly to testify." You know, in the ancient world, when you had ancient history writers, ancient historiographers, in the ancient world, the best kind of history was that history that was written by those who were eyewitnesses, or at least those who were recording the testimony of eyewitnesses. In the ancient mind, the best kind of witness were those people who really were there. If it was some kind of a group or some kind of a political group or a religious group, whatever it might be, somebody who was an insider. That's the best kind of witness that you could have. And that's what Peter is saying here, is that we can attest to his resurrection from the dead because he appeared not to everybody, but he appeared to those who would be the best witnesses possible, those who knew him personally, those people who had eaten with him and drank with him, those people who knew him the best, who could absolutely claim with complete veracity that, yes, this is that individual, Jesus, our teacher, whom we know so well, who had been crucified, and now, 3 days later, this is him alive again. And so there's this emphasis upon the eyewitness testimony. That's what you see in the Gospels. That's the reason why the Gospels are this kind of ancient historiography. This is one of those things that that people in our day, a lot of times, they kind of have a problem with. A lot of skeptics of the Bible like to dismiss the Gospel accounts, because they're not written like modern history writing. They don't have footnotes. They're not giving exact quotes of everything. They are summarizing things. They don't always record things in chronological or sequential order the way we might do. They don't give a bibliography at the end and just in detail explain all of their sources and all that. It's not modern history writing. But it's the kind of history writing you saw in the ancient Greco-Roman world. That's the reason why no one really doubts this anymore. There used to be a controversy about it, but not really is there a controversy now among even scholars, that the kind of genre that the Gospels are, well, they're ancient historiography. They're ancient biography. Or the Greek term was bios. Bios, from which we get our English word biography. They're ancient accounts of the life of this great figure. And that's what the Gospels are, and they're absolutely emphasizing this eyewitness testimony. Do you realize that that's the reason why there's the emphasis upon the 12 apostles in the Gospels? Remember how Luke, in Luke chapter 6 and verse 13, he lists the 12 apostles there. He also lists the 12 apostles again in Acts chapter 1, volume 2 of his account, Acts chapter 1, verse 13. You ever wondered why he does that? In both volumes, he lists these 12 apostles. In fact, really in Acts chapter 1, he explains that there was a replacement apostle for Judas, the traitor, and so there's this emphasis upon Matthias and how Matthias then takes the place of Judas. So now you have a full complement of 12 apostles again. And so what you see Luke doing twice in this two-volume record, he lists these apostles. Why did he do that? It's not so that students in Bible Lab would have a question worth 12 points on next week's exam. That's not why it's in there. It's because this material is, as Luke explained in his prologue, it's based upon the eyewitness testimony. It's culled out from their eyewitness testimony. And so what is Luke doing here? He's recording for us. He's recording for his audience who his sources are. It's not a bibliography at the end of the book, or it's not in a footnote or something like we might do. But this is what you did in the ancient world. He's giving you the eyewitnesses who gave him this information about Jesus. And what you see the gospel gospel account being is largely focusing in upon Jesus' ministry. His ministry as an adult when he was about 30 and he began to teach. And that's when he came in contact with these apostles. That's when they began to follow him. And so that's the aspect of his life that they're able to bear witness to give testimony to. And so that's what he's doing here. He's recording that eyewitness testimony. Now, there are some portions of Luke's material that the apostles, they wouldn't have been privy to that knowledge firsthand. For example, the birth narratives in Luke's gospel. You know, the first couple of chapters of Luke's gospel, he focuses in upon the birth of John the Baptist to Elizabeth and Zacharias and all the incidents there. He focuses in upon the birth of Jesus to Mary and what had happened there. And the apostles were not around. They were not born yet, probably, and certainly were not around to be witnesses. Well, so where did you get your information, Luke? Well, do you appreciate what he's saying here in Luke chapter 2, verse 19, as he's giving this birth narrative? He says at the end of it, well, Mary treasured all these things, pondering them in her heart. And then the incident that Luke records when Jesus was 12, and he's the only gospel writer that records this, when Jesus, the family left Jerusalem to go back to Galilee, and Jesus stayed there on at Jerusalem. And he's asking questions of all the Jewish rabbis at the temple and all that. His parents have left without him. They go back trying to find him. They're all worried. And there he is. He's in his father's house, he said, taking care of his father's business. And in chapter 2 and verse 51, it says that Jesus then went home with Mary and Joseph, and he continued in subjection to them, and his mother treasured all these things in her heart. Why is Luke emphasizing that point? Well, I think it's pretty obvious. She's his source. She's the one whom he got his information from. She's the witness there of these things in that early part of Jesus' life. And that's why he refers to her. That's why he emphasizes her and emphasizes her as treasuring all these things in her heart. What about the things of the crucifixion? You know, the vast majority of the apostles weren't witnesses to that. John's gospel says John was. But all the other apostles fled when Jesus was arrested. Even Peter, he denied him three times. And so Luke records in chapter 23, verses 26 through 49, he records all the events that are taking place at the cross of Jesus. In verse 49, he says, all Jesus' acquaintances and the women who accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance, seeing these things. Why does he give that information? Why does he say that? It's not just some trivia. No, he's explaining, these are the ones whom I have interviewed. In fact, he goes on to talk about the women in regard to the burial of Jesus in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, and then the discovery of the empty tomb 3 days later. He records those events in Luke 23, verse 26, all the way through chapter 24 and verse 11. And so in chapter 23, verse 55, as he's describing the events of the burial and how Joseph was burying the body of Jesus in Joseph's tomb, Luke, the author, says, now the women who had come with him out of Galilee, the same ones whom he'd been talking about as witnessing there the crucifixion events, the women who had come with him out of Galilee followed and saw the tomb and how his body was laid. And then in chapter 24, verses 9 and 10, after he has now recounted these women who come on the first day of the week and they discover the stone rolled away and the tomb is empty, the body of Jesus has been gone, angels saying he's been resurrected from the dead. And verses 9 and 10 say, and they returned from the tomb and reported all these things to the 11 and to all the rest. And then he names them. Now they were Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary the mother of James. Also the other women with them were telling these things to the apostles. You see what Luke is doing in his gospel? He tells you at the very beginning of it, I'm writing an account having investigated everything carefully from the eyewitness reports and the bulk of his material about Jesus' ministry and his teaching and his miracles and all these things. Well, the 12 apostles are the ones who attest to all of that. And even ultimately the post-resurrection appearances to the apostles. Well, they can attest to all that. But then these other things that the apostles were not privy to, were not eyewitnesses to, well, Luke makes it clear where he's getting his information. And so what you see is an ancient historiographer writing in the style of how ancient biographers would do this. He's giving the evidence for the claims of Jesus. It's the evidence of Jesus' miraculous deeds that the eyewitnesses observed and this testimony that he's recording from the eyewitnesses. And it's powerful evidence. I'll tell you what, it's powerful evidence for the veracity of those miracles. In fact, I'll just show you this kind of parenthetically. You know, the Jewish Talmud, that record of oral traditions of the Jewish rabbis. It was compiled, the Babylonian Talmud, around AD 600. But there are rabbinic traditions there that refer to Jesus and what the non-Christian rabbis had to say about Jesus. I think it's interesting what they acknowledge. They acknowledge he was of the royal lineage, just like the Gospels all affirm about Jesus. He was of that royal line of David. The rabbinic sages say that Jesus said he came to add to the law, not to destroy it. Kind of reminds you of what Matthew says in Matthew chapter 5, where he records Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, saying, do not think I came to abolish the law. I did not come to abolish it, but to fulfill it. The Talmud acknowledges that Jesus was crucified at Passover, just like the Gospels talk about. And here's the main thing I wanted to just point out to you that relates to tonight's lesson. The Talmud acknowledges that Jesus and his disciples did healings and miracles. Now, the Talmud attributes them to sorcery. But you see what they're saying? You see, when they talk about sorcery, that's another way of saying exactly what the Gospels say, that the Jews who were not believing in Jesus were saying at the time when Jesus would excise these demons and heal this demon-possessed person of their blindness or their deafness that the demon had afflicted them with. And they were saying even at the time, well, he does these miracles by the power of Satan. He does it by the power of Beelzebub. Or in other words, he practices sorcery. But the point in all this is that you see that even in later generations, those unbelieving Jews who would have more than anybody else wanted to give some naturalistic type of explanation to dismiss the miracles of Jesus if they could, even they never claimed they weren't real miracles. No, every bit of evidence that we have is that even Jesus' enemies were acknowledging he really did these miracles. Now they attributed them to the power of Satan. Maybe that's how he's able to do them. But I think that's pretty good corroboration for what those witnesses have been saying all along about the miracles of Jesus. Now, you and I can judge whether the suggestion that he did it because he's in league with the devil, whether that is more credible than Jesus' own claims. You judge that for yourself. But again, what we see in all this is powerful evidence for Jesus. What do modern skeptics do with this? What do skeptics in our day do with this testimony from the eyewitnesses that we have recorded in these four Gospels? What do they say about the Gospels? What I want you to understand, I think all of us need to understand this, is that in our day and time, those academic skeptics, they deny the historicity of the Gospel material by and large. They reject the claims of the Gospel writers that they're recording eyewitness testimony. Oh, they can't be recording testimony of real eyewitnesses. It has to just be legendary material that accumulated over the generations. That's what modern skeptics say. That the Gospel data is largely unhistorical, that it was concocted, if not purposely, at least innocently was believed because it really was just legendary material that were kind of urban-type legends that people in over the generations began to believe about Jesus. That's what modern day skeptics, that's what they try to affirm. And this is something that has been brewing since the beginning of modern literary criticism and all of that. 19th century rationalists, they were these skeptics coming on the scene and saying, well, basically all the miraculous stuff that you see in the Bible, just excise that. Just take it out and everything else you can believe. But the miraculous, we just can't accept that. That doesn't fit with our modern mind of how the world works. Miracles can't happen. And so the rationalists just said, just take everything that's miraculous out of the Bible and what's left, that's what really happened. Then you had some individuals like David Strauss, who in 1835 wrote a book and he said, you know what, all you rationalists, you're not going far enough. Because if these documents are giving unhistorical legends when it comes to the miracle stories, why just say that's a miracle and not the rest? I mean, that's a legend and not the rest of it. And so Strauss said, virtually all that's in these Gospels, it's all just legendary material that accumulated over generations. Rudolf Bultmann in the 20th century especially carried on this kind of concept. And what you have in our day currently are skeptics, and they're the ones, by the way, who are interviewed in the documentaries and in the magazine articles and all of that, like the Jesus Seminar Group. They're the ones who say that this material about Jesus, it's not eyewitness testimony, it's not something that is credible, don't believe this. And in fact, what groups like the Jesus Seminar do, they gather together and they look at various portions of the gospel and they determine based upon their own their own criteria. I don't have time to talk to you about all of their criteria right now. But on the basis of their criteria, they determine whether or not they think this given portion of the gospel is historical or not.
whether Jesus really did what it says that he did, whether he really said what it says that he said. And they presume in all of this that it's basically just legendary material. And I'll tell you what the problem is with all that. There's not enough time for legends to just be able to develop without the real eyewitnesses being there to correct any kind of misinformation. It used to be, that the most skeptical of the skeptics tried to not even date the Gospels in the first century, but say, well, they're just late second century products. Can't say that anymore. And so now, and the reason why they can't say it is because we just have too much evidence. They are first century documents. Now, everybody acknowledges the Gospel of John was written toward the end of the first century. Everybody acknowledges Matthew's Gospel, Luke's Gospel was written at the latest in the 80s or 90s. Now, I personally think that actually they were written a few decades earlier than that, but I just mean everybody at least acknowledges Matthew and Luke were written by the 80s or the 90s, and everybody acknowledges that at least one of the Gospels, they usually say Mark, was written at least by AD 70. That's just 40 years. 40 years from the time of Jesus. 40 years from the time when Jesus was crucified. And so basically what you've got is skeptics in our day and time who are trying to get people to believe that the material in the Gospels, it's not eyewitness-based testimony at all. It's really legends that sort of cropped up, and like urban legends that tend to crop up in various societies. And so people say, well, I've heard this. Oh, really? Have you heard that? I don't know if it's true or not. Well, I don't know, but I've heard it. And so people then start believing it. And so all this stuff about Jesus and the Gospels, it's in large measure just a bunch of legends like that. And yet, according to even the skeptics' admission, the first of the Gospels is already recording these miracles of Jesus just 40 years after Jesus' crucifixion. Not a lot of time. Let me mention this to you. Here's a quote from the Jesus Seminar. Here's how they view the Gospels. They say the Gospels are now assumed to be narratives in which the memory of Jesus is embellished by mythic elements that express the church's faith in him and by plausible fictions that enhance the telling of the Gospel story for first century listeners who knew about divine men and miracle workers firsthand. Let me see if I can explain what they're trying to say in a few words. Basically what they're saying is, you know what, Jesus, yeah, he was a miracle worker like other miracle workers in the ancient world. And a lot of legends kind of crop up around some of these charismatic figures. Jesus wasn't the only one. And so there's a lot of plausible fictions that people believe. It's not historical. But it's plausible, in their minds at least it is, and so they've heard that this is true. Now, it's a myth, it's a legend, but they've heard that it's maybe true, and so they believe it. And that's what these gospel writers have recorded. Not eyewitness testimony, it's just this information from legend that they've recorded, and it's just like the same kind of legends you see about other miracle workers in the ancient world. You know what they're trying to compare Jesus and the evidence for his miracles to? Let me explain to you. Miracle workers like supposedly Apollonius, who flourished around AD 80, and we know about him as a supposed miracle worker because a man named Philostratus wrote a biography, an ancient biography, recording these things about Apollonius. And recording a whole bunch of things that he did, various miracles, how he levitated,
how he did some other things. In fact, a lot of them kind of are similar to the kinds of miracles the Gospels talk about with Jesus. Usually people have thought that that Philostratus maybe kind of used the Jesus stories in the Gospels and kind of used that to kind of craft his story about Apollonius and his alleged miracles. But Philostratus, when he writes this, he never claims it's based upon eyewitness testimony. He just says, this is what is said about the various miracles of Apollonius. And so modern skeptics try to say, well, that's all the Gospels are doing about Jesus. But you know what? You know how long after Apollonius lived that Philostratus recorded this material about Apollonius as a miracle worker? Do you know how long it was? 140 years later. 140 years after Apollonius died, that's when you have the first recorded account of him supposedly doing various miracles. 140 years. How much time had elapsed, by everybody's admission, before the first gospel, the first of the four gospels, was recorded? How much time after Jesus' crucifixion before the first gospel was written? No more than 40 years. At the most. Maybe less, but no more than 40. Who's still around 40 years later? Eyewitnesses. No eyewitnesses around 140 years later for Apollonius. But you have modern skeptics who say, well, the accounts of Jesus and his miracles, it's just like the accounts of Honi, the circle drawer, in the Mishnah. Here's one of their big comparisons. I want you to be aware of it. You know the story of Honi? It's in the Mishnah, the very first of the rabbinic documents. Honi, or Onias, as he's also called. He was a priest among a Jewish community in Egypt. And it was a time of drought. And the Mishnah says that they came to Honi and they said, our crops are failing. We desperately need rain. And the Mishnah says that Honi took a stick and he drew a circle on the ground. He got in the circle and he prayed to God for there to be rain. And there's just a little trickle of rain. And so he knew that wasn't sufficient. He gets back in the circle and so he prays to God again. And he says, Father, we need more rain than that for our crops and all that. And so the Mishnah says, and it began to rain. It began to deluge. In fact, it rained so much, he had to get back in the circle and say, Father, please turn it off. Somewhere, you know, it's meet in the middle here. That's the supposed analogy with the miracles of Jesus. That kind of sounds more like the miracle of Marty and the lights to me. But that's the supposed analogy. That's what the gospel evidence for Jesus. It's of the same caliber. You know how long after Honi lived that the Mishnah was written? Honi lived in around 75 B.C. The Mishnah was written 275 years later. And that's the supposed evidence here. Now, nobody in our day believes that Honi really did, you know, pray and it miraculously rained. But the point they're trying to say is, well, that's how legends just arise. And so the Gospels are just the same kind of thing, legends. But the Gospels, the first of the Gospel written no more than 40 years later. Not 275 years. Or another one, Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. Founder of Buddhism, flourished around 525 B.C., the first of the documents that speaks about supernatural deeds associated with the Buddha is the Tripitaka, the three bowls. And this is the same kind of phenomenon you're seeing with the Gospels. Legends that arise, and so there's no eyewitnesses and all that. And, well, you know how long after Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, lived that the Tripitaka was written? First record of, or first account of any of these supernatural deeds? 450 years later. When you're talking about Jesus, by everybody's admission, all four of those Gospels are written just a few decades after the first of those, just 40 years, while the eyewitnesses are still around. They're still alive.
The evidence for Jesus.
It's evidence based upon his miracles. And it's the kind of miracle that people could witness and know is a true miracle and not have some other kind of naturalistic explanation. And even the enemies of Jesus have always acknowledged in ancient times, he really did these miracles. Maybe didn't by the power of Satan, but he really did them. But in our modern day, you got people saying, oh, no, 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 no. It's just legends that arose over time. But there's not enough time. There's not enough time. And the main thing, though, even beyond all that, is that it absolutely means that these modern skeptics completely and totally ignore what the gospel writers say is their source material. They say it comes from eyewitnesses. That's what Luke explicitly says. And he even records who those witnesses are. In the way they do it in ancient historiography, these are the witnesses. But modern skeptics, oh, no, 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 no. Can't be really based on eyewitness testimony. Has to be just legend. Well, how do you know it's legend? Well, it just has to be. Because that's the way that it went with ancient miracle workers. And Jesus has to be in the same class as all the rest of them. But with these other supposed miracle workers, you've got generations and generations and generations before you have any of these accounts of their alleged miracles. With Jesus, you've got gospel accounts still in the same century, just a few decades later, just 40 years later before it's all being recorded. And it's right when the eyewitnesses, whoever the eyewitnesses were, would still be there. Folks, this is the evidence for those bold claims of Jesus. And what I want to say to you tonight is that the boldness of Jesus' claims, and they are bold, but it's equally matched by evidence that is also bold and powerful and comes from eyewitnesses and comes from those gospel writers who are claiming and alleging, this is eyewitness material. This is where I got it. And they're calling upon all of us then to look at it and be the judge and to determine for ourselves, is this credible testimony or is it not? And so each one of us have to make up our own mind. But I'll tell you what, it sure seems to me that the modern skeptics of this evidence, they don't have much of a leg to stand on. So I want to talk with you about this theme this morning and tonight, because we're trying to deal with the question of, well, who was Jesus? And as we said this morning, he absolutely demands that you accept some bold things about him. And they are absolutely amazing claims. But the evidence for those claims, it's also amazing and amazingly powerful. For someone tonight who believes the testimony is true and you want to commit your life to Jesus, we urge you to make that known. Let us be of help to you. While together we stand and sing the song of encouragement.